my wife and I run a magazine in northern Pennsylvania and southern New York that has 100,000 readers called Mountain Home. It's a kind of new experimental kind of thing that seems to be working. People love classical storytelling and art. And I'm writing another book on the murder of one of the richest women in the world by a famous scientist at the turn of the century. And that murder was covered up, and I'll be uncovering it.
So you split your writing time between talking about mountain living and murders.
Yes, right. I mean, we're living in a town of 3,342 people. I think that's the latest. That is very much like a Norman Rockwell town. So I think it's probably, if you're going to immerse yourself in all this kind of darkness, you need some kind of relief.
Would you consider yourself a crimophile?
No, I you know, I just consider myself a journalist, a writer, a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And though I think that as storytellers, we have the license, the commandment, to the calling to take on all the great stories of human nature we can find. So, I don't mean to over-exaggerate it, but I try to look to classical models. You look at Dostoevsky or Shakespeare or whoever, and they wrote about all of this stuff. So why can't we?
So how was it then that you came to write The Murder Room?
I had finished Close to Shore, which was a bestseller about the first shark attack in American history in 1916.
Didn't that play some kind of role, sort of in kind of getting that story of the Jaws attack?
Yes, it's the true story of Jaws in the sense that it's the only attack. It's in both the movie and the book. If there are sort of Jaws fans, where Murray Hamilton and the rest of them are on the beach, and the police chief is reluctant to close the beaches, and finally the biologist says, you know, if you don't, it's going to be like a dinner bell out there on July 4th, just like it was in New Jersey, 1916. And it's the case where there was a alleged rogue shark killed four people in a couple of weeks in 1916. And Woodrow Wilson was trying to hunt it down and so forth. So it's a true story. And I was a Philadelphia Inquirer reporter, and less than an hour from my house was the Jersey Shore, and I stumbled on it and did that. And then when I was done, I was looking for another book. And in that, I guess, increasingly modern, serendipitous way, found the Vidocq Society on the Internet, which surprised me because I'd been a Philadelphia reporter for 8 years, and they were right there in Philadelphia, and I'd never heard of them.
Were you surprised at all when you heard about this? I mean, what were your thoughts when you first heard about this?
Well, just like maybe yours, I opened the website, and it said Cuisine and Crime, and there was this elegant Victorian-type, you know, marble-clad entrance to a walnut room, and the world's greatest detectives meet once a month to unpuzzle some of the most daunting crimes in the world. And they do it pro bono in the name of a much more famous detective than most we know about, Eugene Vidocq, who was a sort of forerunner of Sherlock Holmes and all, but in real life in 1820s France. And I thought, this can't be real. This is like the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen or some sort of James Bond thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I called them up and met with them, and I was pretty amazed. I really then didn't know what I was getting into. Over time, the three principal characters, Richard Walter, the so-called living Sherlock Holmes, the forensic profiler, and then the forensic artist, Frank Bender, and then the FBI agent, Private Eye, Bill Fleischer. Just incredible characters.
All outsized characters.
Right. And Fleischer not only tolerates that, he loves characters. He was a federal agent and a bureaucrat for 30 years, and now has his own Private Eye agency in Philly that he calls the FBI for the little guy or the other guy or whatever. But he loves characters, and he's a character himself. I mean, he waves around copies of Hugo's Les Miserables and talks about redeeming victims like Bishop Mirlet did. And he's Jewish, but he loves Bishop Mirlet, and he's just a fascinating guy.
I wonder if your experience was the same as my experience reading the book, which is, frankly, all of my journalism skeptical bells were going off. I wonder, did you have that experience when you were meeting these outsized characters and listening to the kinds of stories that they were telling you?
No, I didn't, actually. I was amazed by them, but I think that there are incredible characters in the world, and I was lucky enough to meet some of them. I think that we tend to. One of the nice reviews of the book was from a New York Times bestselling thriller writer who said that I was daring people to believe things that were not believable, because reality is stronger stuff than fiction. And I think in fiction, and frankly, often in journalism, we take reality and we make it, put it in a place that's more cozy for us. And I tried not to do that. I tried to look at it unsparingly, both in the graphic horror, and I think it goes pretty far in that direction, mm-hmm. but also in the not being embarrassed to write about love and heroism and you know, un-PC things like corny puns, you know, and people who stand up for good versus evil, and we'll talk about that. I think those things are so striking in today's day and age, they make us go, what? What's this?
Yeah. For those who aren't familiar, who do the members of the VDOC Society say they are, and what do they say that they can do?
Well, they started as a social club, and they're Eugene VDOC lived to be 82, so there are 82 members of full members, and then there are various associate members. And they meet on the third Thursday of the month, about 9 months a year now, and they consider cold cases brought before them pro bono, and the cases have to be at least 2 years old and unsolved, obviously, and there has to be participation by the local police department. They're there as helping the police, advising them. They're in the background. They're not there to take credit or steal a case or anything. They don't have that kind of authority. And the cases, police will come to them, and grieving family members will often urge the police to get involved. From all over the country, big departments, small departments, because they include, you know, you're sitting at a luncheon with two of the greatest five criminal profilers in the world, Robert Ressler of the FBI, who's now ailing, unfortunately, but he's a member, along with Walter, who is, one of the top five profilers. And then you'll have over at another table, a distinguished, the Delaware State pathologist, a woman, and then somewhere else, the pathologist who identified CIA hostage William Buckley's remains years ago, and then, a psychic even, and all kinds of experts, leading experts in the world in just about every forensic, fire investigation, arson investigation, mob busters, terrorism, all in one place. And it's been said that they're the greatest collection of forensic talent ever assembled in one room, and that I don't think that's much of an exaggeration when you think of the range of ability there.
I can only imagine what it's like for family members to try to or want to petition or come to members of the society. What is it like for members of police departments, large or small, to come there to these luncheons?
It's I think it's a powerful experience for them. What'll happen, and it's, it's very moving or fascinating to watch, because you'll be in this elegant Victorian former men's club. There are obviously men and women in the VDOC Society, including the district attorney or former district attorney of Philadelphia, Lynn Abraham. And there'll be a four-course lunch and the white tablecloths and an elegant sort of setting. And then the fifth course is there's a screen at the head of the room and a PowerPoint, and up whirls the photograph of a headless corpse or, a rape victim, murder. And the police are up there at the front of the room with a PowerPoint, and they basically are going through the case. The members of the VDOC Society have written summaries of the case in front of them, and they listen to the cops summarize the case and go through it point by point, pointing out all the blood stains in the living room and how the living room goes into, and this was disturbed in the bathroom and so forth. And the type of officers who appear range from, like, gray-haired fellows who are near retirement, and it's that one case, we think this is just sort of corny TV stuff, but it's real, that one case they just really, are dying to solve. Or, like recently, there was a young cop from I can't remember the name, but it was a sort of desert area outside of Los Angeles, a small department. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times in a cold case, a new chief will come in and he'll say, we got to take care of this Ruiz case. We can get some publicity for it, or we need to do it. And he'll turn to some greenhorn who's just his first case and say, look through these 10 boxes and figure it out. So that kind of detective will appear before the VDOC Society. And they're very eager, if not desperate, for help. And they can get amazing results from the trip they make.
What kind of results does the society produce?
Well, it's like anything. It's all about the people and relationships. This is a volunteer thing, and the VDOC Society investigates cases that they think they can help on and fascinate them, and with people they think they can work with. And if there's that kind of bond, at the very least, they have a luncheon, a free trip to Philadelphia. They meet these famous detectives, and the detectives will ask kind of questions that seem maybe kind of basic, but maybe they haven't thought of. Do you still have the door in evidence that had the blood on it 30 years ago? Have you checked that now for DNA? Have you looked at the phone records? I mean, some of these things are obvious, but when a lot of minds are working in one room, it can be powerful. And then the particularly gifted profiler, Richard Walter, can often see right through to the likely killer in a matter of half an hour, and stands up often at the end and give a little tutorial, as he calls it, on, you know, the motive behind this kind of thing. And if there's that bond working, Walter or another expert whose expertise is needed, like a pathologist or a forensic anthropologist, mm-hmm. will fly out, or a working team of them, to the department in, say, Colorado or wherever, and do consultation and help them. For instance, ABC 2020 did a one-hour special on the book, or drawn from the book, in September. You can see it online. And they had come, they meaning Coos Bay, Oregon police, had come to the Vidocq Society earlier this year with help on the 10-year-old cold murder of Leah Freeman, who was a very cute blonde high school girl who a lot of promise, and she was disappeared, murdered when she was 15 years old. And for 10 years, it had gone unsolved. Everyone in the town, or many people in the town, thought what a lot of people think in these situations, well, what about the boyfriend, who is this very sort of macho 18-year-old guy? But the police could never put it together in terms of the clear evidence that would convict this guy. Well, Richard Walter went out there, and it's not that he found different evidence, although he did help point them to new alleys to look at, but he gave that sort of Sherlock Holmes, I call it Dostoevsky view, of the human heart and the darkness involved, based on his experience, an extensive experience, to say, look at this. This is the story. This is the circumstantial story, the case here. And, you know, the police and the DA went, holy cow, we can do this. And they arrested the guy within a matter of weeks. And so it really is that difference between justice and not justice in many cases.
Do any of these people that you spoke with, members of the VDOC, whether it's Walter or Bender or whoever, did you ever get the sense from them that there is, in their minds, a truly unsolvable crime?
No. Richard Walter, then would never acknowledge that. In fact, he does not. He's something of a character, as you can tell from reading the book, and this is how he sounds. Gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, I may be wrong, but of course I haven't been wrong since 1944. He did admit to me one case that he couldn't solve or didn't solve, or one mistake he made, but I don't think he thinks any crime is unsolvable. What's beyond reach, and he will say it right out, and others will, is, for instance, Robert Ressler gave a presentation in private. No one was invited in. I mean, sometimes there are guests, and sometimes even the media, for limited portions of the luncheon where there isn't, actual crime, confidential crime details coming out, there aren't from the police. And Robert Ressler, they hosted this luncheon and like 200 members looking at the JonBenet Ramsey case. Mm-hmm. And Ressler had been hired by, I think, a TV station. So he'd had, access to a lot of the material. And Richard Walter has a lot of contacts inside who know things that happened and were found and weren't found and have never come to light. And they have sharply different theories. Walter's is so horrifying that he was doing an interview with CNN and they cut it right off. They couldn't take it. The point is that although he believes he knows who did it, and given his record, I'm not going to dispute him, he doesn't think he'll ever be justice because, I think justice is an eternal thing. I think good and evil are eternal things, but their interpretation is definitely societal, right. And there's no desire for justice, sadly. I mean, I think it's a horrifying thought that there's that kind of, that people can get away with the depraved murder of a six-year-old girl, and there's not an outcry for justice somewhere, but there's not the passion that there needs to be out there. Cold cases to be sort of thawed need a tremendous amount of it starts with love, to be really corny, from family members who just will not let it go, and then the police have to be dedicated and the DA has to say okay, etc. So there are many cases. I think one of the lessons of the book is that there are many cases beyond the reach of justice, and these guys just and women just sort of shrug and go on to the next one, but it pisses them off. Does that make sense to you?
No, it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. As you mentioned, this is a volunteer society, and sure, yes, they get to come to Philadelphia and have a nice lunch, once a month or so. But what are the motivating forces for these people that come together to do this? I mean, is it that sense of justice? Is it the sense of challenge, being presented with a challenge that others haven't been able to solve? Is it something else?
Well, I think you've hit on the main things. I know that, and there he doesn't speak for all of them, but he's somewhat representative and dramatic at it. Is Richard Walter, when I've been touring with him on the book, and we've been speaking at forensic colleges as well as elsewhere, and a lot of media stuff. But the someone asked him at a forensic college, why do you do this? And he said, a recent study indicates there are perhaps as many as 100,000 killers who got away with it in the last 30 years in this country. And ladies and gentlemen, I think that's wrong. Can I catch all of them? No. Or can we catch all of them? No. Can we help relieve some pain, some suffering, maybe find justice here and there? Yes, we can. Can we make a stand for those values that need to be passed down for civilization's sake from one to the next? Yes, we must. And then he said, so you see, ladies and gentlemen, we're not just doing this as murder here, and we're not here tonight as murder for voyeur purposes. We're here as Americans trying to do the right thing.